Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Instead of firing the moon rock straight back to Earth, they sent the cabin into lunar orbit for rendezvous with the mothership and transferred the rock before coming back. Why is this of significance? This is the exact technique you would need to practice and do if you are to get samples back from Mars. So they've already proven the technique necessary to do that, which no other country has done.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. The story of China in space is not one that's widely known or properly understood in Western corridors, although China, of course, has been launching rockets for almost 1,000 years. Today, we welcome back author and Chinese space expert Brian Harvey to help us address that. Brian, welcome back to Extended.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's wonderful to have you back, and it's a great topic I'm totally naive and don't know much about. So before we get going, can you tell me a little bit about how you got so interested and knowledgeable on space exploration in China?
It was because it was one of the mystery programs in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. The Soviet and Russian space programs were interesting because we knew not as much about them as we felt we should. Some of it was kept back from us, much less, I think, than we thought. But you had to work quite hard to find out what was going on there. In the 1980s, Glasnost arrived in the Soviet Union. Things became a lot more open, but we still didn't know very much about China. Not many people seemed interested in the Chinese space program, so I began to look at it and tried to see where could I start in looking at this. It seems funny now. It's now such a big, in some respects, but not all respects, well-known program. But in the 1990s, when I started, we knew so very little about it.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Well, let's go back to the beginning and understand a bit more where it started. I mentioned, you know, launching rockets for 1,000 years. Of course, rockets were originated in China. Let's start there. Tell us a little bit about the history of the rocket in China.
Well, we don't often realize that the rocket does, in fact, come from China in around 1272-1274, when the Chinese used rockets to defend themselves from invaders from the northwest. And these were more than fireworks. They were much more sophisticated than that, and they were a lot more deadly than that. The interesting thing is, how did they find their way westward? And the Chinese, in the course of time, exported these rockets to India. And the Indians used them in a vain attempt to hold off the invasion of the East India Company in around 1798. But when the British, who were victorious against the Indians, seized these rockets, they brought them back to Britain, which is how they arrived in Europe. And I believe you can still find some of these Indian war rockets in the Woolwich Arsenal Museum, so I'm told. If you ever saw the television series called Sharp with Sean Bean, you will notice an episode in which Wellington had rocket troops. And these were based on the Indian rockets seized in India in 1798 and which had come all the long way from China. So that's how rockets reached Europe and, in the course of time, the United States and the other countries that became the initial leaders in space exploration. So it's a long and very interesting trail back.
Yeah, it very much is so. Well, and we know so much more about how rocket-powered vehicles then started to emerge in Western environments. But how did the Chinese start to manipulate them and start to think about using them to explore space and to go higher than our atmosphere?
Essentially, the key date here is 1949, which was the foundation of the People's Republic of China. Chairman Mao famously said, "Now China has stood up in the world." And he began the project for the modernization of China, of which technology was part. The key person involved in this was his foreign minister, Zhou Enlai, and he invited Chinese scientists from abroad to return to China and to help in the process of modernization. Many of them did. They had been educated in the Soviet Union, in Germany, in France, in Britain, and the United States. But the key person here was Chen Shushen. Chen Shushen was one of the founders, although you don't often hear this repeated, of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, the very laboratory that I think we can say has conquered the solar system. He was one of the founders. He was involved in the early rocket experiments out in the desert with Frank Molina and colleagues in the period before World War II. In the period after World War II, Chen Shushen was sent to Germany by the United States Army to look at the remains of the German A4 V2 rocket and to help in the process of repatriating that rocket and its personnel, people like Wernher von Braun, to the United States. Chen Shushen in the late 1940s drew up designs for rocket planes. He was featured in American newspapers and magazines quite a lot. But in 1953-54, he was accused of being a communist spy. And the outcome of his house arrest for 2 years was that at the end of that time, he was expelled from China as a communist spy in exchange for some people returning from China. Some Americans subsequently called this the biggest blunder we ever made. And that's probably not far wide of the mark. Yeah. When Chen Shushen disembarked via Hong Kong, he was met immediately on the other side of the border by Zhou Enlai, who knew very much the man's capability and said, "I want you to set up and start the Chinese space program." And it was founded on the 8th of October, 1956. And those of us who know our dates well will be aware that this was four days short of a year of the launch of the first Sputnik. So the Chinese space program was founded pretty well exactly a year before Sputnik was launched. But let's remember, China in the 1950s, the most sophisticated form of technology then was the bicycle and a diesel engine for a truck. China had suffered so much from what it called the century of humiliation when it had been occupied by no less than 19 Western powers and who had declared and exercised sovereignty over a lot of the east coast of China. The Americans even had once occupied Beijing and put up the Stars and Stripes over Tiananmen Square. So this was and indeed remains deeply felt by the Chinese themselves. They'd then been through the war with Japan from the early 1930s, and then their own struggle between the nationalists and the communists. So it was a country post-war that was devastated, greatly weakened, with very little technology, industry, advanced agriculture, or anything on those lines. So that is why Chairman Mao's phrase of "China must now stand up" takes an added significance, and the rocket project was part of that.
It's fascinating. I didn't know about Chen Shushen at all, and I was really intrigued to read about that. I genuinely have never heard of the guy, and I'd never heard of what had happened. So it's fascinating stuff. But Sputnik was launched, of course, from the Soviet Union. That kicked off a whole raft of programs post-war. The Americans, the Soviets were competing. How then did China sneak under the radar to start developing its own space exploration program?
When Sputnik was launched, there was amazement around China, and the amateur astronomers went out into their backyards to look at Sputnik flying over, as they did throughout the entire world. The Chinese had an alliance with the Russians at that time. They asked the Russians for their rocket designs. The Chinese always accused the Russians of sending them their old rocket designs. But Chairman Mao said in May 1958, China too must have its own Earth satellites. So we set Sian Shushen to work. They set up a cosmodrome, a rocket launch center in northwestern China, so far away that it couldn't be found by the Americans, which it was almost immediately by U-2 spy planes operating out of Japan. So they built a cosmodrome in northwest China. China might well, under the guidance of Sian Shushen, have put a satellite into orbit much earlier than it did. But in 1966 began the Cultural Revolution, which caused chaos in China. Zhou Enlai managed to protect the space program from the worst excesses of the Cultural Revolution. But at the end of the day, it was not until April 1970 when China was able to launch its first artificial Earth satellite after the Soviet Union, the United States, France, and Japan, which beat China by just a few months. The Americans, of course, having excellent intelligence, knew that all this was going on, and indeed were prompted to help the Japanese space program because they saw China as a rival to Japan and did so. But in any case, China's first satellite was orbited, causing great excitement around China. I met someone who went out and actually saw that satellite way back at that time.
It must have been quite a sight. Must have been quite a sight for them.
It was, and it was called the Dongfang Hong, which means the East is red. And its sole function was to play the Chinese national anthem, also called Dongfang Hong. But the most interesting thing, perhaps, is that Zhou Enlai insisted that to the announcement of the launch be added the following phrase: "We did this through our own unaided efforts." And that is a key thing, because let's remember, China had been blockaded by the United States and other Western countries from 1949 onwards. So even if they'd wanted to get it, they couldn't get Western technology to help them. So they did truly have to learn to do it all by themselves, with the benefit of the human resources of the people who had come back to China. And Zhou Enlai always made it very clear that he didn't mind what the political affiliations were of those who returned, provided they didn't cause some difficulty, he hoped, as long as they had the preparedness to work for China, as the chief designer, Sian Shushen, did.
And you mentioned the launch site there and it being pretty quickly discovered. But jumping ahead, one of the comments about the Chinese space program is they launch predominantly over land. Has that always been the case?
Yes. If we look at launch sites worldwide, a lot of launch sites are located by the seaside. Look at the two Japanese launch sites, Kagoshima and Tanegashima. Look at Cape Canaveral, Vandenberg in California, Kourou in Guyana. It's a long list. However, in certain cases, some countries located their launch sites well inland. Baikonur, the Soviet Union, the classic case, where the Americans couldn't find it. That didn't last very long either. so the desert launch sites had the advantage of taking off over relatively, but not entirely, unpopulated areas. So our second class of launch site is the inland launch site that is often governed, I think, by semi-military or indeed military or Cold War type situations. And Xuquan in northwest China was one of those.
Right, okay. And I think it's fair to say then that the Chinese the development of the space program accelerated from that point quite rapidly, didn't it?
Compared to now, it was actually quite slow. What the Chinese did, though, their launch rate was quite low until the past 10 to 15 years, typically only about four or five launches. And indeed, in the 70s, 80s, there were some years when there were no launches whatsoever. But this is the critical thing. They did adopt a big leap forward type strategy on doing some big projects early on. No sooner had they launched the Dongfang Hong than they progressed to a recoverable satellite called the Fanhao Shiwaixing, which was launched in 1975. But this was actually plan to launch a astronaut, cosmonaut, Hang Tianyuan, as they call them, into orbit from a very early stage, quite possibly an idea coming from Chairman Mao himself. So they built a new spaceship, the Shuguang, the size of the American Gemini capsule. If you've seen pictures of it, you could get two people inside it. They even trained a squad of early cosmonauts to fly it. But in 1975, 74, they realized that this was really too ambitious for them. So they converted it into a satellite that did Earth observations and was also used for scientific purposes. But they then quickly went on to communication satellites. The Chinese leadership in the mid-70s considered that communication satellites were the key to the modernization of China. Chinese people had been amazed during the visit of President Nixon in 1972 to see him followed around by a television van. And they said, if they can do that, we can do that too. So in the 1970s, the Chinese commissioned a large rocket that could get a satellite into 24-hour orbit, which was a great leap forward compared to what they'd done before. This also meant that they need to master hydrogen technology, and the Chinese became only the third country to do so. And in order to get to equatorial orbit, which is the suitable place for communication satellites, they needed a launch site much closer to the equator. So they chose a second launch site called Zhaicheng, which is in Sichuan in southwest China, in a very scenic location in the mountains, in high mountains. It's a very awkward spot to get at, but there were railways there. If you look at the size of the Chinese rockets, they're guided by what is the maximum diameter that can get through a railway tunnel.
Right, okay.
so that they built in 1984, they completed work on the Long March 3, which launched into orbit the first Chinese communication satellite. And that became the basis for national television broadcasting, radio broadcasting, telephone communications. And in the course of time, that became the basis for electronic communication and indeed mobile phones were as soon put through satellite as they were put through masts on hills. So China now has launched about 20 communication satellites and they have a complete entire national system of communication satellites going back to 1984. And then after that, the next big leap forward was 1992, when the decision was taken to begin a piloted manned space program, although the first human space flight did not take place till 2003.
Absolutely fascinating. What a journey they've been on. One question before we move on then, Brian. Did they at all benefit through espionage from developments either in the Soviet Union or in the West?
There was no contact between China and the Soviet Union from 1960, the year of the Great Split, to 1992, when China went shopping in Moscow and bought a docking device, an escape device, navigation system, and spacesuits. And that is about all that they bought from them, and a year's training for two potential cosmonauts in Star Town. Right. As for the other countries, it has been relentlessly alleged that the Chinese have stolen technology from other countries. I don't have the impression that China has engaged in industrial espionage any more than any other advanced industrial country has.
Yeah.
We must remember that in the early days of the Soviet space advances, it was alleged that they were imitative, that they'd stolen the technology from the West. The underlying assumption was that they were far too stupid people to be able to do this by themselves. But they were cunning enough to steal. That is the underlying logic of this presupposition.
Right.
Beyond the observation that industrial espionage is quite widespread, there's no particular evidence that suggests that China has built its space program on stolen or somehow illegally acquired a technology. Right. The evidence just isn't there for that. And we may have to come, albeit reluctantly, on the part of some people, that they actually did do this by themselves.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Let's go on to talk about their launching their humans into space then, because they became the third nation to do that.
China became the third country to put its own person into space on the 15th of October 2003, when Yang Liwei spent an entire day in space, the longest first flight of any spacefaring nation. The program had been started in 1992. The spaceship was called Shenzhou. It looks somewhat like the Soviet-Russian Soyuz cabin. But there and again, it was designed to do somewhat similar things to the Shenzhou. It's like if you look at most modern cars from a distant observer, they do have certain features in common, but it doesn't mean that all are imitative of each other.
Sure. Yeah. So
Shenzhou was tested in an unmanned mode on four flights, and Shenzhou 5 was the first manned flight. Progress of the Shenzhou program was quite slow. The next flight wasn't for several years. The next one, which was a two-person flight for 6 days. The next one was a short flight that involved a spacewalk. And it wasn't until 2012 that the Chinese put a small space laboratory into orbit called the Tiangong-1, and then sent up the first crew to occupy it. And the first occupations were, again, quite short. If you look at the Shenzhou series, it's only got up to 15 at this stage. So it's been a slow program. I think many of us assumed that it would be like the early days of the Russian-American space race, with a lot of launches in a short period of time. But that's not how it worked. China's initial objective was to set up its own space station. China asked to join the International Space Station in the period 1992-3-4. The Americans said no, which effectively obliged to set up their own space station. So the Shenzhou series began, as I said, with a number of shorter flights, then the occupation of two small space laboratories, Tiangong-1 and Tiangong-2, with periods of occupation of up to 33 days. But the real big development began in April, 2 years ago, 2021, with the launch of a core module of a China space station. The overall station is called the Chang'e with no number. This was had to wait for the building of a big rocket, the Long March 5, able to put a payload of 23 to 25 tons into orbit. And since then, the Chinese have constructed their first big goal in manned spaceflight, a permanently occupied space station, which has two other modules, Mengtian and Wentian, which were joined to the Tianhe last year. In December of last year, you saw the first handover of crews, in which a new crew arrived when there already was one crew on board. And after several days, the old crew came back down to Earth. So we can confidently say that as from December of last year, there will always be Chinese Hangtian Yuan orbiting the Earth on a permanent basis. China has its own small space station to rival that of the International Space Station. It is best compared to the Soviet-Russian Mir space station. Slightly smaller than that. It's the same as the original configuration of Mir. But if we could put it in a scientific context, the Chang'e station has no less than 37 tons of scientific equipment on orbit. So This is an advanced scientific facility permanently orbiting the Earth. And it will still be, I imagine, circling the Earth with Chinese Hangtian Yuan on board into the 2040s. And the International Space Station, its termination date has been set for the 31st of January 2031. So the China Space Station will undoubtedly outlive the ISS.
Yeah, fascinating. They also, on the steps of the space station, had some other massive milestones. They've had their first Chinese woman in space as well. But what I wanted to ask you, in that leap from, satellites to manned space flight to space station. Am I right calling it a space station?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. To space station. They were not standing still in terms of a wider exploration of space either, were they?
No, by no means. In the 1980s, following the communication satellites, which are now built up into a national network, they introduced weather satellites called the Feng Yun from 1988, and they have weather satellites both at low altitude and high altitude circling the Earth. It's a permanent and well-established system. In the year 2000, the Chinese began to build a system of navigation satellites called the Baidu. China now has 35 navigation satellites in orbit, which comprise a global system comparable to GPS and the Russian GLONASS. They also began a series of Earth observation satellites called Haiyang and Haiyan. It's now called CHEOS, which is a global observation satellite of Guofen observation satellites, which have a resolution of as little as 50 centimeters. In the mid-2010s, China's launch rate began to take off. And in 2018, China became the world's leading spacefaring nation by the number of launches, overtaking both Russia and the United States. Last year, China made 64 launches. It was actually in second place because the SpaceX Falcon 9 has been so extraordinarily successful. But most of China's satellites that go into orbit are actually applications satellites. They are there to do the navigation work, communications, Earth observations, marine observations, science and technology testing. And then, of course, there's the deep space program beyond that. But it's now what you might call a full spectrum superpower status. There is no area of space exploration that the Chinese do not do.
No, interesting stuff. Let me drag you back again, because there's another question I want to go back and ask you about. I'm fascinated by the work they've done exploring and visiting the moon. Can you just take us through that process and the early and the more recent launches that we know a bit more about, the rover and so forth? But where did that all start?
It started in the 1990s when there was a campaign by a number of leading Chinese scientists, Ouyang Xian being the main one, for China to have a lunar program. And there was a big debate in China at leadership level about whether they could afford to do a human spaceflight program and a lunar program at the same time. Just because this wasn't fought out in the newspapers doesn't mean that this debate didn't happen, because it did. And eventually, the leadership of Jiang Zemin was persuaded that there should be a lunar program. This finally got underway in 2007 with Chang'e 1, which was the first Chinese probe to orbit the moon. It took place at a time when China, Japan, and India all sent probes to the moon within a very short period. And Japan actually won that particular one, but it was China that had the staying power. Chang'e 2, several years later, flew low over the moon, mapping out potential landing sites. Because if you're going to land on the moon, you need your own good maps, high-quality maps. And from Chang'e came the most detailed, beautiful maps you've ever seen of the moon. This led, in 2013, to Chang'e 3 making a successful soft landing on the moon and deploying a small rover called U2, which worked for a couple of months. This was then followed by the most spectacular mission so far, which was Chang'e 4. And the Chinese did something that not only had they never done before, but nobody had ever done before, which is to land on the far side of the moon, which was an extraordinarily daring mission to undertake. It had been sketched by the Soviet Union in the 1970s, but they'd never actually done it. So they landed on the far side of the moon. The lander, which landed in von Karman crater, it deployed another small rover called the U-2-2, and it began its 50th, I think, lunar day last month. It has now travelled 1,800 meters and has broadcast continuously over that period. Just to tell you how difficult it is, you cannot transmit from the far side of the moon. You have to send up a relay satellite orbiting in an unstable orbit over the moon that you must adjust every week. And that was sent up in advance of Chang'e 4. It's called the Keqiao. It's still working there. This is a very sophisticated operation. The Chinese have built up now a huge database of photographs and other information from the Chang'e 4 U-2-2 probe on the far side of the moon. By the way, Chang'e 3 is still actually operating nearly 10 years later. So it has a very high record of success and achievement here. 3 years ago, China launched its first lunar sample return mission, Chang'e 5, which landed near a volcanic dome called Mons Rümker. And this brought back to Earth, using the same method as on the Apollo program, the significance of which I'll explain in just a moment, to bring moon rock back to Earth. The mothership for this mission, having delivered the cabin back to Earth with the rock, then returned to the moon and is continuing a new mission. So these are very daring and sophisticated things to be doing. Yeah. The two most interesting things from the Chang'e 5 mission, one is there has been a flood of scientific papers issued since then, in which by examining the rocks, you can tell the past history of the moon, and you can actually rewrite, and they have rewritten, the past early history of the moon. So it's been back to square one for our geological knowledge of the moon. But the other thing is that they used a much more sophisticated method to get rock back from Earth. to Earth from the moon. Instead of firing the moon rock straight back to Earth as the Russians did in the 1970s, they sent the cabin into lunar orbit for rendezvous with the mothership and transferred the rock before coming back. The same technique as Apollo. Why is this of significance? The answer is very straightforward. This is the exact technique you would need to practice and do if you are to get samples back from Mars. So they've already proven the technique necessary to do that, which no other country has done. But the Chang'e program has been enormously successful.
Yeah.
It will lead to a recovery of rocks from the far side by Chang'e 6, scheduled for next year, a lander, rover, and hopper at the South Pole in 2026 or 7 approximately. And then Chang'e 8 will be what's called in-situ resource utilization. There is a 1.5-ton laboratory on the top of Chang'e 8 that will scoop up rock and see, can we turn this into air and water for fuel and for all the many other purposes for which we might need it. And these projects are now well-defined and well underway.
It's just, I'm just flabbergasted by the speed at which this program evolved. And I suppose it takes me to then ask the question, Brian. We in the West, in my experience, we started to become more familiar with the Chinese space program when I think we started to see things like Chang'e 4 and the rover and the pride at which, and quite rightly so, they expressed about the success of missions like that. How were things changing with the openness the Chinese are having with their space program? Because, you know, historically, the Americans had with low risk to achieve success. So lots of testing, lots of training, lots of thing, little failure, whereas the Russian and Soviet culture was slightly different, more basic technology, more rigid technology, but equally as successful. We're now seeing the Chinese emerge and they're becoming very open about their program. How do you see that unfolding? Are we going to see more live launches? Are they more confident in doing that now? Are we starting to see that so that we, you know, I suppose from a human race perspective, are starting to share those experiences?
The answer is somewhat mixed to that. Chang'e 1 that I mentioned to you, you could pay 200 euros and go watch the launch.
Oh, okay.
So it can't be that secret a program.
Yeah.
Wenchang, which is the launch site on the island of Hainan on the southeast of China, is a tourist resort. Thousands and thousands of people flock there for the launches. They book up hotel rooms months in advance in order to get the best views from the balconies of the ascending rockets.
Right.
At the same time, there are other parts of the Chinese space program that are not so accessible. You can't just walk in to Xuquan Cosmodrome. Taiyuan, one of their other bases, that is also true. On the other side of things, one has to say that the Chinese announced their plans for space exploration in 2009 when they published Roadmap 2050. Which essentially laid out everything that they plan to do for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, which no other country has done in the same way. And they've been doing exactly what they said they would.
Yeah.
So, again, that is an example of openness. If you look at the countries that belong to COSPAR, which is the International Committee on Space Research, to which all nations have joined since the start of the space age. It must have at least 100 members. Only about 6 countries actually publish their annual reports on their space activities. China is one of them, and the report runs to 200 pages. So there are many examples of China being very open indeed about its space program. China does do military satellites. About 21% of its launches are military. And we there are ways of good ways of calculating that reliable, and right. they are essentially for optical and radar reconnaissance. And the Chinese don't tell us much about them, but neither does any other country yeah. tell us very much about their military satellites. So that there are degrees of openness and non-openness in all the countries around the world. If you go to international conferences, lots of COSPAR, such as the International Astronautics Federation, China always sends, COVID notwithstanding in recent years, a strong delegation.
Right.
They present a lot of papers. You can go and talk to them, and they are very willing to respond to requests for information and so on and so forth. They publicize their space program in many different ways. As a journalist, I wish they could do more, and I've said to them there are ways in which you could do a lot more and be more open and tell us more things. But it would be wrong to portray it as a secret program. That would not be at all fair on the information flow and what we know that they are doing in recent years. So in a sense, many of the things that could be said of China's both positively and negatively, you could say that of any other space program in the world.
Absolutely.
It's not that different.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Are there any plans or programs to go to places like Mars in their forward-looking program, or potentially any other planets like Saturn or anywhere like that?
Yes, there are. In 3 years ago, China sent its first spacecraft to Mars. This was called Tianwen. We now call it Tianwen-1. This was an astonishingly ambitious mission. On China's first mission to Mars, they said, we will send an orbiter and a lander and a rover all in one. And like the lunar program, they were successful first time out, which says a lot about the technical capacities, preparatory work, which we know went back 20 years, because again, I come back to the issue of openness. If you read the Chinese papers, which they publish conveniently for us in English in the China Journal of Space Technology. Go look, it's all there. They tell you what they're thinking of doing. And where you see a paper saying, exploring the aerodynamic qualities of a lander descending to Mars, that is a very clear indication that they're thinking of doing exactly that. So we had these indications of Mars planning going back to the early years of this century. Anyway, to come back to the present time, Tianwen did orbit Mars, and it is still orbiting Mars and sending back information from Mars orbit. A lander descended to the surface. A rover called Zhurong then set out from that landing point. It traveled for a period whereby it covered almost 2,000 meters across the dunes of Mars. It went into hibernation last May when the Martian winter arrived. It was supposed to emerge from hibernation in December, but has not yet done so. The temperature reports on Mars suggest that the temperature is still colder than the point at which the thermostat would awaken it. So hopes are high that it will actually awaken. But again, as was the case with Chang'e 4 and Chang'e 5 on the moon, a lot of thinking and ideas, knowledge of our Mars has been revised on foot of the work of this extraordinary rover that was successful first time out. So China's already achieved a great success with its first ever Mars mission. This will be followed by Tianwen-2 in 2 or 3 years' time, which will fly to 2 asteroids. For close observation, though it has to be added that Chang'e 2 has already intercepted an asteroid way back about 15 years ago. Tianwen-3 is a very interesting mission. this will do with Mars what Chang'e 5 did with the moon. In other words, it will descend to the surface of Mars, collect samples, bring them back to an orbiter, and deliver them back to Earth. And the present timing, if they do accomplish this, means that the first Mars samples to be examined on Earth will be examined in Beijing, not in Houston, Texas, if they're successful in this. And the preparatory work for that mission is well underway at the moment. This will be followed by Tianwen-4 in the early 2030s, which will fly to Jupiter, fly to one of the moons, and a small spacecraft will separate at the point of Jupiter interception and go on to travel to Uranus. And it will be China's first probe to Uranus. And in the meantime, in the background, we know this is being planned, is the first interstellar spacecraft to be built by China. And the idea is that it will be launched probably in the late 2020s or early 2030s, and that it will have exited the solar system on the way to the stars by 2049 to mark the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic.
Wow. I didn't know any of that, Brian. That's absolutely fascinating and really, really exciting. A couple of questions then before we just wrap things up. I'm a bit conflicted, really, on man's inability to work together for the benefit of all mankind. Maybe it's these rose-tinted glasses I'm wearing. But do you think at any time that China, the Western nations, potentially Russia, it depends what I suppose goes on, will ever really work closely on some of these? Because if they collaborated, surely as humankind, we could accelerate these programs.
There will be collaboration between Russia and China. United States made it very clear to Russia that if it were to join the United States in the return to the moon called the Artemis program, that Russia's relationship with the United States would be entirely subordinate. It would not be like building the ISS where there was an equal partnership. And Russia, as the first country into space, was not prepared to accept a subordinate relationship with the United States under Artemis. So Russia will now construct its own orbital station, for which a date has been set for the beginning of construction in 2027, while they still continue to fly to the International Space Station. But this has inevitably pushed Russia in the direction of China. China, as I mentioned earlier, has been under American blockade since 1949. This blockade was intensified in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, to the point that the United States prohibits any country from flying satellites on Chinese rockets, and there are severe penalties for doing so. China has managed to fly some communication satellites for what you might call marginal economic markets in Africa and South America. But that is all. This has had the effect of denying a revenue stream to the Chinese space program in foreign currency that it might otherwise have. But the degree of blockade remains quite intense and has been intensified in recent years. China wanted to do its navigation satellite program with Europe. The Americans intervened and said, no, you can't do that. As recently as yesterday, the European Space Agency announced that it had no plans to cooperate with China for political reasons. The first time this has ever been stated. There is a small project for a magnetospheric satellite called SMILE, which I presume will stay in the pipelines. But there was a time 4 years ago when European astronauts were training in China. That's over. That's not going to happen now.
Right. Okay.
So China remains isolated from the rest of the world. There is what I can only describe as very strong antipathy towards China in the United States Congress. This is not a White House thing. It's a congressional thing. Recent polling found that 80% of Republicans and 60% of Democrats disapprove, that was the question asked, of China. And there is firm resolve that the isolation of China from the world space community should continue. So that in effect, China and Russia find themselves in this new bipolar world working together. This is a much more severe situation than existed during the Cold War in its early days, because it was agreed in the early days of the Cold War that scientific achievements and scientific exploration together should be shared between the United States and Europe and the Soviet Union. There were even proposals in 1962-3 that the Apollo program be a joint program between the United States and the Soviet Union. And had President Kennedy not been assassinated, that might well have been it. And Kennedy said very articulately that space must be a politics-free zone. Sadly, that's not what has happened. And the trend is to an ever more hostile situation. You may well see, and the concrete outcome of Chinese-Russian collaboration is intended to be what's called the ILRS, the International Lunar Research Station, which was agreed between the two countries in St. Petersburg in 2021. And the two countries can bring quite different things to this particular party. China has the most modern space facilities in the world. The unfortunate Russians, who have not had the money to invent in some cases even in cyclical maintenance, must weep when they see the Chinese facilities of all their steel and glass and new cosmodromes and so on. China has the youngest workforce in the space industry in the world. The average age in the Chinese space industry is 27, which raises the questions that if they're achieving what they are achieving now, what will they not achieve in the next 10 to 20 years? Russia can bring a huge reserve of knowledge and experience of its own space programs dating back to the 1940s and 1950s. They know all the mistakes to not make. The Russians still have the best rocket engines in the world, simply because they started early in 1928 building their first rocket engine design bureau. The Chinese have much more by way of resources and money. So the fusion of these two particular programs could actually be quite powerful. The Chinese have published their designs for landing their own Hangtian on the moon, now with Russia. The design of the Long March 9, which is their huge rocket that will do this, was finalized only in the past few months. The Russians will contribute their own new piloted spacecraft called the Orel, and it will be part, and their new Angara rocket as well. So we know what will be the elements of the International Lunar Research Station, though I suspect China will probably be in the leadership role, the situation in Europe notwithstanding, and who knows where that will go. But the Chinese will lead, I suspect, this project, and the Chinese say they would like to establish a base on the moon in the 2030s. It is often said that this is a new race. The Chinese have always said, and I believe them, that they're not actually racing anybody. If you consider that China sees itself as a long-standing scientific nation whose work in astronomy goes back to 2000 years BC, and whose scientific civilization was the subject of the great books by Joseph Needham in the 1950s, they would see themselves as the world's leading civilization in science across all history. So a few years don't actually make a lot of difference here. So that for the Chinese, the conquest of the Soviet, of the solar system, will take place at their own pace, at a pace in which they're comfortable, which they themselves can afford. So even though it's not a race, I think we can see that what they are doing is happening with a great sense of conviction and deliberation.
Wow, fascinating stuff, Brian. Thank you so much. Tell us again, where can we find you online and get a copy of your book?
Yes, my book is called The Great Leap, and it's on the Chinese Space Program. It's available from springer.com. The publishers are Praxis Springer. So if you look up Brian Harvey at springer.com, you will find the book. It's 2019, and it is also published in Chinese. It's available in China. You are welcome to read it in either language. I don't mind.
I think it'll be a simple choice for me. And I have been reading that book. I've been working my way through it, and it is excellent stuff. Yeah. So, Brian, that's fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Okay. You're very welcome.
That's it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Brian.
Goodbye and thank you.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.